Charlie Klein is 21 years old on the night of October 29th, 1969, sitting in room 3420 of Boulter Hall on the UCLA campus in Los Angeles. It is 10:30 in the evening. The room is quiet. Most of the building is empty. In front of him sits a terminal connected to a large research computer called an SDS Sigma 7, and wired into that terminal is a separate piece of equipment, the size of a large refrigerator that has been delivered 2 months earlier by a Cambridge company called BBN. The cost was $100,000. The machine is called an interface message processor, and it is the first one of its kind ever built. 350 miles north at the Stanford Research Institute in Menlo Park, a programmer named Bill Duval sits at a similar setup, wired to a different computer, the SDS 940. The two interface message processors are connected, for the first time tonight, by a leased phone line from AT&T. Each man, Klein and Duval, has a telephone handset pressed to his ear with his other hand. They are talking to each other. They have to. The link is so new that they do not yet trust the equipment to confirm whether characters are arriving. Klein reads each letter aloud as he types it, and Duval reads it back. Klein types the letter L. "Got the L?" he asks into the phone. Duval says yes. Klein types the letter O. "Got the O?" "Yes." Klein types the letter G. The SRI computer crashes. The first message ever sent over the ancestor of the internet is, therefore, two letters long. L-O, as in the beginning of the word login. As Leonard Kleinrock, the UCLA professor whose lab made it happen, said many years later, you could not have asked for a more succinct, more powerful, more prophetic message. Lo, behold, about an hour later, with the SRI machine rebooted, they got the full login through. The crash had nothing to do with the principal. The principle had worked. Two computers, 350 miles apart, made by different manufacturers, running different operating systems, had exchanged information over a single wire. The lab kept a small handwritten logbook of the night's experiments. The entry for the L O moment reads, simply, talk to SRI, host to host. No exclamation marks. No celebration. Just a line in a logbook, dated, signed by initials, filed away in a drawer. This is Rust, gently. A patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 14, The Open Protocols. Today I want to tell you a story about how computers learn to talk to each other and, more importantly, about a particular kind of choice that the early designers of that conversation made, which is a reason you can sit in your kitchen and load a web page from a computer in Stockholm without having to know who owns either computer or what software they run or which company they have a contract with. By the end of this episode, you will understand why the internet is shaped the way it is, why it has no owner, and why the alternatives that competed against it, every one of which had more money and more polish and more corporate backing, lost. Let me back up to that refrigerator-sized box in the basement at UCLA, because the box is the answer. The interface message processor was built on a particular idea. The idea was that the computers at the two ends of a connection should be doing all the smart work, and the network in between them should be doing as little as possible. The network's job was to move small chunks of data, called packets, from one place to another, and not to think about what was in them, and not to keep track of what they meant, and not to remember anything afterward. The computers at the ends were responsible for assembling the packets back into messages, for noticing if a packet was lost, for asking for it again. The network was dumb on purpose. The intelligence lived at the edges. This sounds, today, like an obvious choice. It was not obvious then. The telephone companies, who had built every other large communication network in the world, had built them on exactly the opposite principle. The phone network was extremely smart. It set up a circuit between you and the person you were calling, held that circuit open for the entire call, and provided guaranteed quality of service. Their network was the brain. Your telephone was, by comparison, almost a paperweight. The telephone companies looked at the design of the new computer network, with its dumb middle and its smart edges, and they laughed. They said this would never scale. They said it was naive. They said real engineers built smart networks, and the design coming out of these university research labs was, frankly, embarrassing. Two men in their early 30s, named Vince Cerf at Stanford and Bob Kahn at the Federal Research Agency DARPA, took the dumb network principle and pushed it further. Kahn had a problem in the spring of 1973. There were now several incompatible computer networks, the original ARPANET, a satellite network, a packet radio network, each with its own private rules, and none of them could talk to each other. He came to Cerf with the question, how do you make networks of networks work together? The two of them spent the next year and a half working on the answer. In May of 1974, they published a paper in an IEEE journal that proposed two protocols working together that would let any computer on any network reach any other computer on any other network, anywhere in the world. The protocols were called TCP, the Transmission Control Protocol, and IP, the Internet Protocol. TCP handled the smart edge work. It assembled packets, noticed losses, asked for resends, kept track of order. IP handled the dumb middle. It moved a single packet from one address to another address. And that was the whole job. Together, they formed TCP/IP, the language all the computers on the internet have spoken to each other ever since. On January 1, 1983, the original ARPANET cut over from its older protocol to TCP/IP. The day was called Flag Day. Every machine on the network had to be ready. There was no going back. It was the kind of coordinated change that today no organization would attempt. It worked. The number of computers on the network that morning was about 400. Most of them belonged to universities and research labs. Within a decade, the same protocol will be running on millions of machines. Within three decades, on billions. The cutover was painful. The engineers grumbled for months afterward, and the choice of a single January day to move the whole network at once became, in retrospect, one of the most consequential coordinated acts in the history of computing. Once TCP/IP existed, the question that mattered was what people would build on top of it. The protocol itself moved bytes between computers. What the bytes meant, what kind of conversation they encoded, was up to whoever wanted to invent the conversation. And here, the second consequential choice was made, a choice nobody had to make, but several people did, almost in parallel, almost without coordinating with each other. They made their inventions free and open and unowned. The most important of those people was a 33-year-old British software engineer working at CERN, the European Particle Physics Laboratory in Geneva, named Tim Berners-Lee. On March 12, 1989, Berners-Lee submitted an 18-page proposal to his manager, a man named Mike Sendall. The proposal was titled Information Management, a Proposal. It described a way for the physicists at CERN to share documents with each other across the network, with links inside the documents that pointed to other documents, which could be anywhere in the world. Sendall took the proposal, read it carefully, and wrote on the cover page in pencil, vague but exciting. Then he found a budget reason to buy Berners-Lee a next computer, one of the machines from Steve Jobs' company during his exile from Apple, and let him work on it part-time. On Christmas Day of 1990, Berners-Lee opened the first web page on the first web browser on a NextCube at CERN that had a paper sticker on the side reading, "This machine is a server. Do not power it down." The entire World Wide Web was that morning that single computer. In April of 1993, CERN signed away all of its rights to the work and made the web royalty-free forever. No license fee, no corporate owner, no central authority. Anyone, anywhere, could write a web page, publish it on any computer, and link to anyone else's page without asking permission from anybody. The decision saved nothing for CERN financially, since CERN was a physics laboratory, not a software company, and had no real interest in monetizing the technology. the decision did something else. It made the web a kind of public good, a piece of infrastructure that belonged to no one and therefore to everybody. There has never been a serious effort to take it back. There is no central organization with a legal standing to do so. The result on the other side of that decision was that within 2 years, the open web had eaten almost every walled garden on the internet. There were several. CompuServe was the oldest, 3 million subscribers at its peak in 1995. Prodigy peaked at 2 million in 1994. AOL would ride dial-up modems to 26 million subscribers by 2002. France had a national network called Minitel, free terminals issued by the phone company to every household, 20,000 services available on it, 10 million connections per month as late as 2009. Every one of these was professionally run, well-funded, easy to use. Every one of them lost. In November of 1993, a 22-year-old undergraduate at the University of Illinois named Mark Andreessen released a free web browser called Mosaic. Within a year, half the people on the internet were using it. Andreessen graduated, moved to California, was recruited by Silicon Graphics founder named Jim Clark, and co-founded Netscape. Their browser, Navigator, ran on 90% of the web by 1995. On August 9th of that year, Netscape went public, raised $140 million, and crossed $2 billion in valuation within hours of trading. The company had never turned a profit. The dot-com era began that afternoon. What lost in all of these stories was not poor execution. The losing networks were well executed. What lost was the closed model. CompuServe owned its content. AOL owned its content. Minitel was owned by the French government. Every one of them charged for access, controlled what was published, and demanded a relationship with the user. The open web charged nothing, controlled nothing, and demanded nothing. The user could leave at any moment for any other web page on any other computer, and there was no friction at all in doing so. The deep lesson is that, in computer networks, the platform that demands the least of its users tends to win. Open beat closed not because open was more polished, but because open did not stand in the way. The internet you use today is shaped by a series of these choices, made by a small number of people at a small number of moments who could have charged for what they made and chose not to, and who could have kept it private and chose to give it away. Three things to carry away from today. The first is that the network at the center of the internet is dumb. It moves packets. It does not think about them. It remembers nothing. The intelligence lives at the edges in the computers you and I own. That is the choice that lets everything else work. The second is that TCP/IP, the protocol that holds the internet together, has no owner. It was published in an academic paper in 1974 and given to the world. The web, which sits on top of it, also has no owner. Someone signed away its rights in 1993. The third is that every closed network that competed against the open internet lost, despite having more money, more polish, more brand recognition, and more professional management. There is a pattern there, and the pattern is older than the internet itself. Next time on Rust, gently, we will look at what happened when the computer left the desk and moved into the pocket. We will sit in a kitchen in Waterloo, Ontario in early 1999 as a small Canadian company ships its first two-way pager. And we will follow what happened to that company and to every other phone company in the world on the morning of January 9th, 2007. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.